This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Staub Audio Engineering. If you have listened to any of the episodes, you have undoubtedly heard me talk about Mike and the phenomenal audio engineering work that he does. His mixes and masters are truly some of the best that I've ever heard. I love working with Mike on all of our Dreamfield tunes, on all of our Summit One tunes. He is an absolute wizard. Make sure to hit him up, inquire about mixing and mastering prices, and take your tracks to the next level. Oh, yeah. And Mike is also one of the nicest, kindest human beings you'll ever meet. Definitely hit him up and work with him.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to all of the producers, artists, and creators that are tuning into the show. My name is Cody Christensen, and you are listening to the Chilled Samples Podcast. To the podcast, man. I am stoked to have you on. We were just chatting a little bit before, and the kind of divine timing of us meeting each other just a couple days ago and getting you in a podcast chair is I think it was meant to happen, man. So I'm really, really grateful that we're both here and chatting with each other on a Friday. So just to kick things off, how's everything going with you?
Good, man. Yeah, absolutely. Just released a debut album, so I'm just sort of stoked. I'm still bending on the thighs of that. So, man, I'm just excited to chat to you.
Yeah, well, and Ollie, I just listened through Dream Cycles, which you released on Sleep Tales, and there is some really phenomenal production techniques. It was so clean, but the most interesting characteristic that I was picking up was some of the high resonant sounds that you were able to sprinkle in, yet keep them extremely clean. I forget the name of the first track on the album, but the kick drum on that track, it has a really nice resonant tone, which for me, I still produce a ton of electronic music, perform electronic music, and it's such an art form of, it's so difficult sometimes to be able to craft those high resonant, high frequency sounds within a mix. And I'm doing that within like heavy electronic music, heavy mid-tempo music. And to hear you do it masterfully in a sleepy Sleep Tales lo-fi album, I was like, wow, this is really creative and interesting. So that really, really piques my interest, man.
Wow. I mean, thank you so much. Kick drums are a weird one for me. I'm terrified, terrified of them. So that you picked up on that is interesting for me. The whole album, I think you're referring to Rest Now, My Dear, is the first track. And if that's the one you mean, I wanted the whole album to feel quite sort of cozy and welcoming, quite warm, quite a sort of blanketed feel. I think a lot of that comes in these sort of little ear candy bits that sort of sit above everything else every now and then. And I tried to sort of get that as much as I could in the everything down to the kick drum. So I'm glad it worked. It may have just been a happy accident, but either way, same result, I guess.
Well, and I guess, what art isn't a happy accident? But another really beautiful aspect was the piano keys that you were using, like the bottom ends of all of the pianos that I was hearing were just so powerful. And I think it comes from that... The bottom end that I was hearing, and I'll do a terrible job at explaining it, but it almost hollow isn't the right word, but like if you were sitting in front of a large grand piano, there was just something about those I don't know if did you record real piano, was that a plug-in of some sort, because you nailed it.
Thank you. It was all plugins, honestly, all virtual instruments. I can't remember all of the ones that I used, but the Imagero piano was the main one. I don't know if you know that one. It's very, it's made by Imagero, incredible artist, sound designer, software engineer, turns out. And he sampled his own piano and made this incredible plugin. And it's only, what, $20, $30, something like that. Really cheap, but sounds phenomenal. Wow. And it's, I think that was the main piano I used across the album. Yeah. Yeah. Just gives these really sort of warm, rich tones and amazing.
Yeah, yeah, beautiful sounds and beautiful tonality. Do you know what I'm talking about in regards to that the bottom end of that piano, like the lower frequency? I'm doing a terrible job at explaining it.
I think I know what you mean, but it just must be the way it's all. Again, probably another one of those happy accidents. It's just the way it all sort of came together in the mix. I wanted a lot of the bass frequencies to be filled, sort of the low end frequencies to be filled by, you know, bass instruments. So I kind of hollow, I guess is the right word. I hollowed out a lot of the piano to just sort of make it sit right, you know. So it might have been a sort of combination of different elements, maybe pads, you know, filling out that low end a bit as well. Just a combination of elements, and it seemed to just sort of gel quite nicely. Yeah.
Yeah, well, and the mixing work was and mixing work, sample selection, it was a really, really good album, man. It's one of the best that I've heard in a really long time. So I was pretty blown away to be listening through it. And,
wow.
Great work on that, Ollie. And I guess before we dive into the process of creating that album, let's take it back and start your story from the beginning. So I guess, Ollie, where are you from, and when did you start getting into music?
Okay, yeah. So I'm from the UK, from England. Been studying music pretty much all my life. I got into, you know, rock bands and stuff as a kid. I was a drummer, listening to lots of, you know, Led Zeppelin and Pink Floyd, and then more sort of Green Day era, things like that, that got me into this sort of rock mindset. So I started doing that more and more. Really enjoyed it, started to study it. When I was studying it, I got into more, you know, funk and soul and started to learn jazz. And at this point, it's all still drums, you know. But a lot of the courses I was studying required me to learn other things, to compose, to you know, play the piano every now and then. So I kind of taught myself little bits here and there. And ironically, now I only ever use piano and guitar. I don't really use my drum knowledge now, but hey, it's weird. yeah, so I carried that through, and then life kind of got in the way. So priorities shifted. I went to the sort of 9-to-5 career aspect, as I think we all do at some point. So I started, I was in car sales for like 2 years, and it was fun, but it wasn't me at all.
Yeah.
A very sort of high paced sort of lifestyle, pretty cutthroat, not very nice, you know?
Yeah.
So I one day just handed in my notice and decided to slow down. I moved to Spain. I booked a one-way ticket to Spain, and, I wanted some nice weather, some calmer mindset, some just more of a time to relax and reshift my life, the way it was going. So I did that. And then while I was there, I decided to pick up music again. Didn't know what I wanted to do. So I bought a Mac with Logic on and started writing little beats. And I sort of very sort of passively did that for about, you know, almost 2 years. Then COVID hit, and COVID sort of really gave me a chance to.
And we are back with Ollie. We had a slight internet issue, which internet allows us to be talking from probably, I don't even know how many miles apart we are, or kilometers. A lot. We're a long ways apart. So there's going to be tech issues that come along with that. But Ollie, we at least where we kicked off or where we stopped, it was you bought a one-way ticket to Spain, my friend. I'm intrigued.
Yes. Yeah. So I did just that. I left my car sales job, bought a one-way ticket to Spain, decided... You know, I wanted a chance to slow down a bit more, to reassess, recalibrate. So that's what I did. I bought a MacBook with Logic on, decided to start making music, sort of using that, the music I'd studied, and somehow try and incorporate that more back into my life. So I did that for sort of passively for about a year or two. And then COVID hit, and it gave me this opportunity to really sort of slow down, as I think it did with a lot of people, really slow down and really sort of rethink things. During COVID, there were lots of, I was into a couple of artists called Galimatias and Medicine. I don't know if you know those guys. Medicine's a very sort of like EDM almost kind of guy. And throughout lockdown, he did a lot of live streams, and I really got hooked on his sort of creation process. In those live streams, someone who frequented it quite a bit was Imagero, who made the piano VST I mentioned earlier. And he was sort of the first person I ever heard about. I didn't really know this genre existed until he was in there a lot. He was sending in samples and music, and it sounded really great. And so I checked him out and sort of fell down a bit of a rabbit hole. Decided I loved that kind of music, this whole scene, and just sort of became aware of its existence kind of thing. So that would have been mid to end of 2020, I think. I just decided to run with it. I really fell in love with the type of music, the people involved. Everyone seemed so sort of friendly and open and warm. So I decided to dive in. I started writing a little bit of music. I was working. COVID was, I was sort of between jobs and things, and I was writing music when I could, and I wrote a couple of songs and released them just sort of independently. At the end of 2020, two songs, I think. They may have hit 1,000 streams by now. I don't know. They're not massive. You know, it wasn't. I was grateful that if my brother heard it. So I sort of ran with that a bit, and I started reaching out to people in the scene to really sort of. To really dive in, and everyone seemed sort of open to help. I think that the biggest thing for me was reaching out to Kurt Stewart. I think he was the first person I reached out to, actually. If you're aware of him and his music, I seemed to resonate quite a lot with what he made, and just sort of his general, what's the word, his general sort of the way he sort of appeared online and things. He had sort of a great aesthetic, and everything was sort of good. So I sort of followed that, reached out to him. And I've got to say, he is the kindest, sweetest guy I've sort of ever met. He opened every door for me. I reached out to, he put like a story up on Instagram, and it was him like mixing something, and I just knew if I was mixing that, I think I said something like, oh man, I'd make such a mess of that. Do you offer any tutorial, one-to-one, some tuition? And he came back and was like, yeah, absolutely. Times are hard at the minute. It's, it's COVID. So, let's do it as and when you're good. And I was like, yeah, give me a week and I'll, I don't want to underpay you. You're mm-hmm. a working artist as I'm trying to be. So I want to be fair. And he was like, do you know what? Forget it. Are you free tonight?
Wow.
Yeah, absolutely. So he said, he was like, for payment. And this, again, this is probably one of my first real interactions in the scene. He said for payment, he wants two things. Number one, this is black music. It's from black culture, black music, black people. That's what it is. Don't be quiet about it. It's like, wow. Okay. Interesting sort of, very sort of powerful lesson straight away. And then he said, number two, if anyone asks you for the information I give you, give it to them for free. Don't charge them for it.
Wow.
And I was like, geez, right. Wow. Okay. Wow. What a guy. Straight away. He's offering these, all this help, and these are the only two forms of payment. It's like, wow, okay. So we sat down for about an hour or two. We got on really well. He liked my music. I showed him one of the tracks that I'd released, one of the sort of two little independent ones, and he really liked it, to the point where he wanted to collab at some point. I was like, geez, you know, I'm maybe hit 20 monthly listeners kind of thing. There's no, you know, he doesn't gain much from collabing with me other than, you know, he must see something in me as an artist. So we did that. And since then, that was my sort of first real release in, I had a couple of little releases in 2021. My first real release was with Kurt on my EP called Botanical, a song called Orchid that is still performing and hitting crazy playlists. I think through his name, you know, well, it's a good song, I'm sure, but it, you know, through everything that sort of happened, all the doors he opened. So that came out in May, I think, April, May. And from then on, it's just been this sort of network of help and kindness, and it's just sort of spread. And whoever I reach out to, whoever I speak to, is so willing and so helpful and so sort of kind and open. And it's what makes me fall in love with this genre, you know, again and again each day. Mm-hmm. And it's just so sort of powerful. And it all started with Kurt for me. Yeah, really, really powerful.
How incredible, man. The uniqueness of our community and the willingness that a majority of artists share in regards to helping others and sharing with others is truly, in my opinion, what makes this community so special. It's unreal.
Sure.
It truly is, especially if you come from any other genre within the music industry. There's no other scene like this. And for Kurt to essentially just give you two rules, two selfless, incredibly inspiring rules, payment. Like, what? That's wild. Yeah. And then for him to continue to work with you and to help you develop and to open those doors, that's, geez, that kind of made me emotional, man. That's really, really cool.
yeah.
Wow.
Really amazing.
It is. Well, and it's, In as far as the story arc of artists entering the scene in 2020, I share a very similar story. That's when I was playing shows with my electronic project, Crystal Grid. Wow. The world shuts down. We can't play shows anymore. I'd been a fan of lo-fi for probably 5 months prior to, and as soon as COVID hit and we were locked down and I knew that I wasn't going to be able to play shows, I just made a hard pivot. And similar to you, I found nothing but welcoming, helpful artists all over the world. And it's so special. And I think it was, and man, I guess I was, I mean, two and a half years ago at this point. And it's interesting to see how many other artists like yourself that kind of came from other genres and other backgrounds that have really embraced this style of music in this community. It's been super inspiring to watch. And I just want to take it back again and share a similar similarity in our stories with that love for classic rock, man. So same. I think the first concert that I went to, I think I was in, I must have been like 10 years old, but my dad took me to Van Halen. You know, he's an autograph collector.
Perfect.
He loves classic rock, so that's what I grew up on. And I remember just being infatuated with Led Zeppelin, and you know, even diving into like the Zoso and all the cymbals, and just getting, I was like 12 or 13. I didn't understand anything, and I'm trying to like figure this out. I'm listening to Stairway to Heaven backwards, you know, doing all the Led Zeppelin fan things. But how did you become a fan of classic rock at such a young age?
I think my friend group that I was in, a lot of them were, they just sort of picked up from their parents, their parents' music taste. And I didn't want to do that personally, because I think none of my family's musical. I'm not from any kind of musical background. And I think my mum's favourite artist is Neil Diamond. So I didn't really want to follow that. As great as Neil Diamond is, I didn't really want to follow that route so much. So my friends, everyone around me was into, they'd already, always picked up their music preference from their parents. And I guess luckily their parents were into good music. So, we started forming bands and stuff and playing Pearl Jam and sort of, I don't know, Red Hot Chili Peppers kind of stuff. And that was kind of, I got sort of told what to play sometimes. Before I'd even heard of Pearl Jam, they're like, "Yeah, we're going to play this song. It's called Even Flow. We're going to rock it. It's going to be." We had like a gig lined up, and I was like, "Yeah, cool. Just tell me what to play." I think most of the songs at the time I hadn't even heard before we'd play them live. They were just like, "Do the drums like this," and then just sort of yell at the crowd and be like, "Yeah, cool." So we kind of just did that, and it all just sort of came from that, and then I followed that route and went into a bit of a rabbit hole with that, and it led me. You know, where it led me.
Wow. Well, and so when you were talking about studying music and studying drums, so was this like secondary school and you were just in like the school bands?
Yeah. Well, yeah. So we had my school system in England was first school, middle school, high school. It's now switched to primary, secondary, but at the time, first, middle and high. And then I think middle school started to, yeah, I played the drums. I'd had some drum lessons quietly in the background, but I was only sort of playing what my teacher thought was good. So I was playing some sort of Nickelback and things like that. And then come high school, we started forming bands, and that's where, me and my friends were in, ended up what being sort of the school band, and it was really cool. And I fell in love with performance through that. But we only stuck that out up until about sixth form, which is, how old are we there? 16, 17, I think. And then they all went off to university in different areas. I sort of stuck around and studied, went to college in the same area. So the band sort of dissolved, but I sort of stuck it out. And I think by then my music taste had changed a bit. So the sort of further education side, so the I guess the university, the college years, that was where the sort of the jazz, the funk, the soul sort of came into it, where I was sort of being taught by I guess all my lecturers were really sort of heavyweight jazz players and sort of free flow jazz kind of stuff, but they also had sort of rock background, so it all sort of converged at this sort of funk jazz point, which was really cool. So I guess that's when it sort of really hit with drums. And that was only for a couple of years, but yeah.
Yeah, well, and then so after that, did you join more bands?
No, so after that, that was when, as soon as I came out of college, I tried, you know, for a few months, I suppose, bands and bits here and there. And then I think just personal circumstance, priorities shifted. And I was like, okay, well, doing what I'm doing right now, I can't really afford to live and go out into the world on my own. So let's get a real job. And I did that, landed somehow into car sales. And I really enjoyed it, but it was a world far removed from what I was used to. You know, I was used to sort of playing rock gigs at dirty dive bars, and I loved it. And then going to, I was selling cars for Jaguar Land Rover, and I had to be the sort
wow.
of most incredible cars, by the way, if anyone has one, really great cars.
Yeah.
But I sort of had to put on a suit every day and sort of pretend to be the most sort of, I don't know, clean, sort of clean cut person, and very, you know, I had to sort of be like that. And it was, again, a very sort of different world. And it was fun to dive into, but yeah, I could only do it for so long, you know.
Well, it's the crisis of living a false identity. And I think it's in, I think there's some people that live their entire lives living in that false identity. And so similar to you, I've gone through a couple different phases of that. For grad school, I went to my undergraduate career was at a small liberal arts college in Southwest Colorado. There's only 3,500 students. Just right. an unbelievable college experience. And then my girlfriend and I, we both had the opportunity to have full rides or free tuition to a private Catholic university in Ohio, which going right. from a small liberal arts school in the mountains of Colorado to a private Catholic university, it was definitely a culture shock. And beautiful people. I wouldn't trade the experience for the world, but it was, I was putting on a little bit of a facade. I was being an actor in some aspects. And don't get me wrong, there was I was still able to let a lot of my authentic self be shown, but at the same time, there was parts that I was hiding or things that I was just going along with because I was in this new culture. And that was it was worth the payoff, but it was a good life moment of like, oh, I don't necessarily like not having the opportunity to be myself. And so I guess what was the tipping point for, I'm sure it was a good job. I'm sure it probably paid well, like Land Rover, Jaguar. So was the tipping point for you to say, I can't do this anymore?
Well, what I think it was a number of things. I don't know if there was any sort of one particular moment, but the whole culture of it was designed to screw people over. When you're selling cars, it's about selling them for as much money as possible, for really you're sort of fighting the customer as much as possible. I remember having when I was training to be a salesman, I was sat down going over sort of a contract review with the salesman with the salesman who was training me, and this couple came in, this lovely couple in their 80s, and they had saved up so much money and bought this dream car, a Land Rover, a Discovery Sport, if anyone knows them, really nice car, and it was absolutely their dream car. And I remember this contract review, they'd had the car for 3 years, loved it to death, and then the contract review came in, and it was I had to leave. Because they broke down. It turns out that the way the salesman had sold it meant that they, by the time it got to this 3 years, they either owed another, you know, 20 grand on the car, or they couldn't keep it. They had to pay that, and they just weren't in a position to financially. And they started, you know, they started breaking down. And I sort of sat there and I just remember sort of feeling really just sort of horrible. I was like, is this the world that I'm really sort of getting into? And at the time, I think I overlooked stuff like that just because, you know, it's on paper, it's such a good job. I wanted to, you know, prove my parents and my loved ones that I could do well and whatever. So I overlooked these sort of things. And it just, after a while, it just really got to me. I couldn't maintain it. I couldn't keep fighting. I'm trying to, from my point of view, I was sort of trying to help these people out, get them into a nice car that they loved. But the way that it worked, that wasn't possible. You weren't trying to help them out. You were trying to get as much money out of them as possible. And again, with cars like that, they're really breaking the bank in it, and it sort of really impacts them financially, obviously going forward. So it's very detrimental stuff to people's lives. And I couldn't do it, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's just that everybody has their own set of morals and their ethics, and you can only toe that line or go over that line so many times before it's self-destructive. And so during this time, you hadn't purchased Logic yet. Were you still playing drums?
Not at all, really. I'd sort of, because this job took so much of my life. The effort that I had to put in, yes, but the hours as well. You'd work 6 days a week, and then your day off would be the customer's day off. So the customer would be calling you, you know, every few hours. So it never really, you live it, you entirely live it. So I couldn't really, I didn't have the Mac at this point. I didn't really make any beats. It was just that. And as a creative, you can never sort of get rid of that. You will mm-hmm. always have some sort of creative passion inside of you. Doesn't matter how long you ignore it, it will always sort of rear its head eventually. I think in this case, it definitely did with me. So I couldn't ignore it for any longer. So yeah.
Wow. And I'm a huge fan of Stephen Pressfield's work, and it's specifically in The War of Art. And he talks about that moment where it's the pain of not pursuing it becomes greater than your life at that current moment. So it sounds like that was that moment for you of suppressing that creativity, became more painful than job insecurity and saying I'm going to leave this nice job and career path.
Yeah, 100%. So like when I went to Spain, this is where I sort of flipped it on its head, and I was earning good money, wearing a suit, selling nice cars, to living by the beach, making cocktails, earning no money at all, but I was so much happier for it. And mm-hmm. because it sort of gave me the time, the freedom, the sort of mental, creative freedom, all sorts of that. Weird one.
Well, it's, and I think there's beginning to be a culture shift, but peace of mind and happiness has been an undervalued commodity. And
for sure.
Like, in it, especially when you look at kind of like the 1980s to the 1990s to the 2000s, like there was such a, and not for everyone, I'm definitely generalizing, but there's kind of clear career trajectories, you know, getting a job in the 80s. Like if you're 25, yeah. you get a job. And my mom followed this path. I think she got a job with a company, I think, at like 21 or 22, and she stayed with them until she retired. And that was a streamlined process. It was safe. There was a clear career trajectory, but I think a lot of people following that path sacrificed happiness, sacrificed their time, sacrificed peace of mind for that security. And I mean, some people crave that security for sure. And I get it. Living life as an artist. Yeah. I mean, you're scrapping and grinding every single day and dealing with imposter syndrome and realizing that it's all on you. But I think for a certain type of creative, it's almost not a choice. It's a life that you have to pursue.
For sure. Do you know the comedian Jimmy Carr? I think he's sort of got some sort of notoriety in the States now. He's an English comedian.
Yeah, he has the goofy laugh, right?
He sounds like a seal. Yeah.
I know him.
Yeah, so he really interestingly, so he I only ever knew of him as the guy with the goofy laugh from TV. And he did a podcast recently with a young entrepreneur called Stephen Bartlett. I think the podcast is called Diary of a CEO. And Jimmy Carr basically talks about happiness. And it's one of the most sort of eye-opening, incredible podcasts I've ever heard. The guy is nothing short of a genius. And it doesn't come across like that in his, you know, in his normal TV appearance. So he's such a sort of philosophical thinker. And listening to that podcast was really interesting. He made a few points about happiness, and especially compared to a creative. He was obviously telling it from a comedian's perspective, but some really sort of poignant moments. One of them being, just to reference that sort of sacrificial element of the security, he mentioned, so people do go through that. They go through that. They come out of college or university and they find it, you know, you get a good job because you're off the back of that. And you think, oh, okay, well, I'll just do this for, it's secure. I'll do this for 40 years or something. I'll come out with a nice pension, 50 years, whatever. But what really are they asking for you? How much, he sort of asked the question, how much for you to give up on your dreams? What, 30 grand, a company car? Is that enough? For most people, I think it is. And it's a sort of really impactful question. It's a powerful question. I think this generation are sort of answering differently, or starting. I think I notice it a lot more with my friends and my peers, all sorts. A lot of obviously everyone in this scene, if they're, you know, if they're a working musician, they've followed, they've rejected that 30 grand in a company car, you know, and that's a very, you know, it's a very nice paycheck. It's a very nice sort of life, but is that enough to give up on your dreams? That's, it's, yeah, that question in particular stuck with me a bit, and it, and I've, yeah, had a lot of thought on it for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and I think it's almost a question that we have to ask ourselves almost every day or every other day, because that, that uncertainty creeps in of like, oh, what am I doing? What am I doing? Is this the path? But then, I mean, immediately followed up by like, what's my other option? And it's like, oh, of course, this is the path that I have to pursue. I think it's the opportunities that we have with technology have just expanded our potential for earning. So let's say like a full-time musician in the 70s or the 80s, it was like, well, okay, you can either be a really good session musician, you can join a band, start a band, you're going to be the next Zeppelin or the next Pink Floyd. There was less avenues to think about, ooh, how do I generate revenue and drive revenue for myself. But now we have the opportunities with social media, whether podcasting, having multiple music projects, selling sample packs, doing online lessons. There's just so many opportunities to try to be creative and drive different revenue streams. Authentically being yourself. And I think that's the coolest part. We have access to an entire world of people. And with that access, you're going to find people that are like-minded. You're going to find people that like what you do, that respect what you do. And more importantly, and especially for us within this community, we have the opportunity to band together and to help each other. And that's so coming from the EDM world, it's the competition is fierce. There's some people that want to help you, but primarily people want to keep secrets and keep doors shut, and they don't want to give out their network. And it's so toxic. And it's exhausting to watch. Especially for the up and coming musicians, it's like, hey guys, you realize if we work together, we can make moves and make strides and make an impact and build a team. And that's what I love most about this community is I feel like I have a team of 35, 40 artists, you know, that I can reach out to for help or collaboration, advice. 60 artists, I don't even know. And even, you know, there's artists that I've never even talked to that are probably on my team or willing to be on my team if you just reach out and ask those questions. So it's still a grind, it's still risky, but the opportunity itself is something that I'm unbelievably grateful for, and I try not to take for granted, because of course I took this phrase from Azito88 Theo. He taught me the phrase hedonic adaptation, and essentially it's you just become accustomed to new things. Let's say you're working a 9-to-5, you get a 10 grand raise or a 20 grand raise. It's not going to take you very long to get used to that. You know, in the moment it might get crazy, but so I try to remind myself of that, of not taking the technology that we have for granted, not taking this community for granted, not taking the opportunities that we have for granted, because we're truly living in a special time to live life as an artist.
Yeah, it's you're right. It's crazy how sort of how many different avenues have opened up for art in general. Going back to the, you know, artists from the 60s, 70s, joining bands, forming bands and things. You had to book as many gigs as possible, burn as many things to CD or whatever, if they didn't have those back then, but, you know, to tape, whatever it was, vinyl at that point. And just hope you made the sales. Hopefully enough, you know, local gigs garnered enough attention that you'd sell some records. And now we've got, you know, the ability to reach not just thousands of people, not just hundreds of thousands, millions of people, literally millions of people. And we can't take that for granted. You know, that's so sort of special, and we're sort of, I don't know. I think if you're creative, you have a responsibility to create, because someone out there will resonate. Someone out there will find value in it, and they deserve to. So try and reach them.
Yeah, man. Well, that's, we, in that, that artistic responsibility, both to yourself, just like we were talking about that, that pain of not doing it grows greater than the pain of doing. No, I got that backwards. You get my drift, but it, the responsibility, to create whatever art is inside you. It's so strange, man. And I think it takes a while to accept it. It certainly did for me. It took a long time for me to be able to look in the mirror and say, you're an artist. And once again, back to hedonic adaptation. Like, I realize that's what I do. I wake up every morning, I get into the studio and I start creating. That's my job. But when I first started out, you know, it's that imposter syndrome of, is this really, like, is this what I'm supposed to do?
Oh, I'm still in that. Yeah, absolutely. That doesn't, that's been a weird adjustment. I don't know how you found it, but me, I've only recently taken this full time. So in the end of March, I quit my last job. And so only since then have I been just doing this full time. And it's such a sort of weird transition. So I've gone from, you know, corporate world. I at this point I was in hospitality, a COVID job, you know. To go from that to having to be down to, I think my employability would be zero now. I don't think anyone would take me on, because before I'd be cleanly shaved, wear a nice shirt, and be somewhere at like 8 in the morning. Whereas now I've got this total expansive freedom that, in a way, I still don't know what to do with. I'm not as structured as I used to be. So I think that's something I've found difficult in that transition. I've been studying a lot about attention lately. And I sort of find, I think, again, something that really arose from my transition into this job, to have that entire creative freedom. I think creation should be free, but I think often, I think personally, especially, I work better within sort of restricted freedom, if that makes sense. Restricted sort of, I have to sort of set myself some kind of limitations and boundaries. And to not have anyone to do that for me, I guess, was a slight sort of, you know, this adjustment. And attention came with it. And what I mean by attention is essentially like, so my world essentially exists on my phone. And it's sort of become this demon that I've had to sort of fight with. I do personally get so addicted to, okay, so I'm sat on Instagram. That's where all the networking's done. So I'm going to sit on Instagram for 10 minutes. Oh, someone's just shared a funny video with me. So I'll sit and scroll videos for 5 minutes. And then all of a sudden I've lost 2 hours and haven't actually got any work done. And then I'll go and write some music, and then someone buzzes my phone, and then it's to do with work. Cool. So I'll check that out so I can stop doing music for two seconds, and then I'll go and do. And then it's all these things. And I think it's sort of, I notice it with a lot of, you know, my friends and peers, and that like attention span in general is going. It's all, everything's TikTok. Everything's like these quick 60-second things, and it's sort of really taking people's focus. I know I've battled with that, and I'm sort of readjusting now. Deleted all my social medias apart from Instagram, and trying to really sort of refocus. There's a guy, there's a very interesting guy called Johan Haris, I'm not sure how to say his name. It's an English scholar, and he's written a lot. There's a book called Stolen Focus that's really interesting. I've started, I'm waiting for it to be delivered, actually. I've listened to the audiobook, but I'm waiting for the actual book to be delivered. And I think this sort of applies to us as creatives. It's about this sort of distraction that everyone's sort of trying to get things done. They're trying to work, but life at the moment is geared towards taking that from them. It's taking that, you know, Facebook is taking your attention. It's not doing its job unless you're on it. Instagram's the same. TikTok's the same. TikTok's even worse. It's probably the worst of them all. Twitter, for an example, its whole idea is that you can say everything you need to in, 140 characters, whatever it is. You can express yourself in seconds, a matter of seconds, and then everyone who you're talking to should digest that in a matter of seconds. And it's been this sort of weird, it's something I've definitely become aware of since being a creative. And if I have, I hope I'm not the only one that sort of that has struggled with this. And I don't know, it's sort of very interesting thing if you really look into it, this sort of attention span crisis that I think everyone's in at the minute, you know?
Ollie, I think I doubt that there's going to be anybody listening to this podcast that isn't addicted to technology or has not faced their own battles with it. And it's such a great point, yeah, man. And so I quit my full-time job last September, and that transition, it was a difficult transition in mind. So our storylines are a little bit flipped. I essentially overstructured myself and overworked myself. I'm kind of a high octane dude. I wake up at 5:30. Like if my alarm's set for 5:30, if I wake up at 4, like I'm getting up and I'm moving.
Wow.
So when I first quit, I was so afraid of it not working that I had overworked myself. I was doing every single biohack that I could possibly do, and I still do a lot of biohacks, but I kind of got to the point where I was using external stimulants as well, which of course is a dangerous trap. And what helped there? I've been sober this entire year, completely sober, which I haven't done since I was like 12 years old. I learned so many lessons in regards to patience and beginning to look at the long game. And done, I mean, I still work, you know, 13 hours a day, but my work is creative work, so I can't, like, there's nothing to complain about necessarily. But I overstructure myself, and now I'm fortunate to be in a place where I'm looking at my productivity over a week, maybe not necessarily a day. And I still have non-negotiables that I get done every day. I still do a shit ton every day. I'm sure people that are listening that have been following my story, they're like, dude, you're insane. You've been waking up at 5:30 for like however many days in a row. And like, I'm training for ultra marathons all the time. So I definitely still jam pack a lot of things into my life. And, you know, I guess running and work has essentially become my drug, but having that structure, I mean, we're both our own bosses. And when I first made that transition, my boss was a dick. I was so hard on myself, man. And I've learned how to become a better boss. And that's been nice for myself. But as far as technology, social media is tough. And I literally have to separate myself from my phone. So even right now, man, my phone is on the ground, like behind me. Like as soon as we started this, I threw it behind me. When I go into, I keep it away from me. And it's so funny. The first hour of my day is dedicated purely to an Ableton session. But what I do is I take out my phone, take a picture of the studio. I do the timestamp, 5:30, 5:40, whatever it is, throw it up on socials. And even in that moment of temptation, first thing in the morning to actually open up the app, post it, I'm careful because I almost feel like Gollum off the Lord of the Rings, you know, like there's that inseparable pull to wanting to open up the app and check the messages. And it's like, that's not what this time is for. I have a time to check my DMs, which are essentially my emails now. And so the way that I think about it is going in to check my emails. I'll respond to everything at once. And then there's also this weird pull of wanting to get back to everybody right away. And it's like, you don't have to, like, think about it like emails. And It's something that I pay attention to every day. I'm by no means am I perfect, but it's something that I continue to work on, because I do realize that every time I open that app, it's me versus software engineers who have studied ways to steal my time and to suck me in. And so I've become aggressively defensive, and that helps with me. The physical separation of the phone, putting it in different rooms, putting it in different spots, like literally separating myself from that gravitational pull that the phone has. So all your 6 months into this full-time journey.
I'd say so.
Aside from the technology, and let's dive into that scheduling a little bit more. Like what, and a lot of the listeners of the podcast are trying to get to that point where they can quit or they have quit their jobs. So what are some of the most impactful things that you've learned thus far in these 6 months, coupled with what you're trying to get better at?
Oh, good question. I think the most impactful thing, especially like you say, if people are trying to reach that point of being able to, you know, take this full time and have that be their career, I think the biggest thing for me was forming relationships, forming the right relationships with the right people, you know, just people that were willing to help and share and love and create and whatever. They're the right people, they're good for you. So if you do that, you can't really go wrong, because you've then just got a good support around you. But to build those relationships, I think something really important is honesty. Being honest with yourself about what you want. Being honest with them. You can't go to them needing something. Relationships work two ways. They're not. It's not just them providing you stuff. You need to provide for them. So if you're not being honest and helpful and supportive on your end, then you know there's no point speaking to anyone. So you need to just sort of, I think, be kind, just sort of really build up a nice network of good people around you, and that was so powerful for me. Starting with Kurt, probably the first person I spoke to in this scene. Lessons learned off him that I carry through, and I think from that things happen. Again, if you're being honest with yourself about what you want and what you're trying to achieve, just by doing it for longer, it happens. It may have been coupled with a lot of luck, but I feel like if you're doing honest work, it just happens. You know, if you're on an honest path, you can't really take a wrong turn. So I think that was really sort of important for me. Something that I tried to, I think at the moment, something that I'm really trying to improve is that attention thing. I'm trying to sort of refocus myself. There's something that I learned when I was in car sales, and something that really sort of helped carry me through, was this concept called MA. It's a Japanese concept, and it started as I believe it's just like an interior design concept. It basically means negative space. It developed to mean intentional emptiness. And I thought, wow, that's really powerful. Mm. If you look at, for example, Studio Ghibli films, Studio Ghibli, I don't know how to say it, the Japanese cinema, things like Spirited Away and Howl's Moving Castle, they're really interesting pieces of cinema, because they have they use the concept of MA. About halfway through, there's a scene that isn't relevant in any way. There's no sort of story development in this scene, but it's a scene where the viewer can sit and rethink, can sort of take a moment to breathe, and then move forward with the progression of the story. And doing that, trying to incorporate that into my life has been so important. So intentional emptiness, essentially. So really sort of taking the time to, and not this, I know it sounds quite lazy at face value, but really sort of taking the time to slow down in a world, like I say, where attention is being taken left, right, center. Having those moments to yourself to recalibrate is so important. So important. And I found a lot of value in that, for sure. For sure.
Well, and I love that concept because it's so simple, right? But in today's day, it isn't simple. And in those moments of silence, how comfortable are you? And through meditation practices, exactly, yeah, through running, I wasn't familiar with this concept of is it Ma? Is that how you say it?
M-A, yeah, Ma.
Ma.
Yeah.
I'm gonna look it up, but it's especially within meditation, yeah, man. And I mean, I've been meditating for years at this point. That in I mean, 5 minutes is my typical meditation span. So by no means professional, but yes, I have been practicing it for a long time. And the amount of thoughts that go through my brain in that 5 minute period, or the amount of times that I get distracted and I have to pull myself back to center, it's hundreds, you know, literally hundreds.
It's so difficult.
It's so difficult, man. Yeah. But it shows how much more I still need to continue to practice and just kind of watching the patterns of my thoughts. And it's interesting how I've recognized as soon as I start thinking about somebody else and criticizing or judging what they're doing, what I'm judging in them is either what I need to work on myself or what I'm most fearful of myself. And so it's
internal projection. 100%.
It's crazy, man. Yeah. And I'll have that. It typically happens. It might happen like two times per week, but like my first thing in the morning, like I just start running through people that I love and like not even people I have issues with. And I start thinking about them. And fortunately at this point I can catch myself really quick, but it's taken a lot of practice. And our default setting for the way that we think and what we think is so skewed negatively. And I think it's probably a default evolutionary survival mentality, but
it's negative bias. 100%. It's the fact that if you're driving along, say you're on the motorway, the highway, and there's a car crash on the left and a really nice field of flowers on the right, which one are you going to look at?
I'll go on left
Everyone is conditioned to think that. I think even like a 10-week-old baby will stare at someone who's got like scowling rather than someone who's smiling. I don't know what it is. I think it's an evolutionary thing to avoid danger, perhaps.
Yeah.
I don't know. So your mind becomes aware of it. I think it's that, but it's definitely a thing. This is why the most engaging content on Facebook, for example, Donald Trump, when in 2016, Donald Trump reached something like 12 times more than Hillary. When was that one? Sorry, I'm not very big. Yeah,
all good.
Yeah, he reached something like 12%. Sorry, 12 times the amount of people on social media because his content was scary and negative. Yep. And not to say it's necessarily bad, but that's what generates engagement, and that's all Facebook, that's all social medias are after. It's engagement. So we are conditioned to think negatively before we think positively. And I think that's a really potentially detrimental thing, for sure.
Yeah, well, detrimental is if you're not aware of it and not working on it. And hopefully we're getting to a place where there's more awareness. And I think because in the age of content, like I follow so many people that inspire me every single day. And so I'm choosing to, and I'm getting better at focusing on content that's inspiring and uplifting. I'm constantly reading. And I think it keeps me plugged into a growth mindset in the opportunity to continuously work on my flaws and what I'm trying to get better at. But even with the amount of time that I dedicate towards self-growth and self-betterment and happiness, I still have so much work to do. And I'm beginning to clearly now see that negative force that I'm up against, and it's a formidable foe. And I think all of us are along those same lines. But once again, I think there's that opportunity for the growth mindset, and especially within our community, the opportunity to talk with other kind of people who are hustling and working hard to try and accomplish their dreams. And the only way to make that happen is to become better, at your art, to become a better person, to become better at time management, scheduling, yada, yada, yada. If we want to do this full time, like there's a lot of things that we have to be good at.
Yeah.
And
for sure.
and continuously working at. And Ollie, as we wrap this up, man, I just for the listeners, I jotted and yourself. We can talk about it offline, but there's four books immediately that I have on my shelves that kind of address some of these issues. Of course, The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield, which is my creative Bible. Turning Pro by Stephen Pressfield, which in regards to especially when you're actually turning pro and you're quitting your full-time job, it's the perfect playbook for, hey, this is the conversations you need to have with yourself in regards to scheduling.
Yeah.
And once again, I cycle through that all the time. I've read it a bajillion times and it's my playbook. Dopamine Nation is an interesting book, talking about how we're essentially overstimulated with dopamine rushes every single day, whether it be drugs, alcohol, food, and especially social media. We have so many opportunities to just trigger dopamine. And the way that she explains it, it's given me just a kind of mathematical view of dopamine in my own brain. Our brains are always looking for homeostasis. We're always trying to be level. So, drugs, perfect example. You have a really, really fun night. You're up until 5 a.m. Well, your dopamine's up to here. Well, the next day, your brain, unfortunately, is going to put yourself in that amount of a deficit. Why? That's just how it works, unfortunately. But it's clear. And same thing with checking social media. You check social media, you boost your dopamine, let's say by 10. Well, your brain's going to put you at negative 10 to compensate and bring you back to zero. So she obviously does a great job at explaining that way better than myself. So check out that book. And then Irresistible is a book talking about the intentional design of social media in regards to stealing your time for their profits. I have not read that book, but it is on my shelf. And my girlfriend read it and she said it was phenomenal. So people that are listening that want expertise, knowledge on those, definitely check those books out.
For sure.
Ollie, I am so grateful that this last minute podcast happened, man, and that we've met and we're in each other's orbits and network now. So, Ollie, if any of the listeners want to reach out, have a conversation with you, follow you, listen to your music, where should they go?
So I've deleted pretty much everything other than Instagram now. So, I'm very active on there. Like I said, my world exists there. So. And as you said, that's become my email inbox now. I mean, you can email me as well, but I don't. Instagram, sure, much easier. It's always.after.noon. That's my Instagram. And then if you want to listen to my stuff, there's a link on there, but it's all Spotify, Apple Music. It's everywhere pretty much, yeah.
Perfect. Well, everybody tuning in, make sure to reach out to Ollie. Ollie, hey, thanks again for sharing your story and your insight, man.
Thank you, man.
That was a ton of fun, dude.
Wasn't it, man? No, thank you.
Of course, Bab. All right, peace out, everybody.
See ya.